always nice to have you guys sitting back down with me. I'm going to keep this quick. You only have a few more days left to save 30% on all of our top selling online courses. If you're somebody that's followed us for a while, you know that we help people become better communicators, meaning navigate the tricky areas of life, especially on the social side. Like, what do you do if you're dealing with people in an organization that don't want to change? What do you do if you're backed into a corner and you don't know how to assert yourself? What do you do if there's a difficult personality that you're trying to lead? Or you've heard about our resources such as Blind Spot, that if you're somebody that's gone to bed at night, you think, man, I like my job and I like a lot of things in my life. I'm really blessed, but I feel like I could be doing more. I just don't know what idea to chase. I don't know who my audience is. I don't know if anybody would listen to me. And even if I did, I don't know where I'd start. All of these resources that we provide help you with these things, and they are 30% off for the only time this year. I get it. I know many of you are already in courses. You have other things going on. These things give you lifetime access. And many of you that are strength coaches that are listening know that you're going to need CEUs. So Bought In, for example, which is my sequel to Conscious Coaching, that gets you 1.8 CEUs through the NSCA, and you're going to need them. And those of you that aren't strength coaches, these things all apply as well. We all need to know how to manage our career. We all need to know how to manage our finances. We all need to know how to manage difficult situations. So please, 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 if you believe in what we do and you've gotten value from this podcast or anything I've ever said, tweeted, Instagrammed, or shared, check it out at least by going to artofcoaching.com/courses. I promise you, if you think our free content is good, our premium and paid content is even better. This is what we do for a living. We go all in. So go to artofcoaching.com/courses and use the code BlackFriday30. It's all one word, BlackFriday30 at checkout. You'll get 30% off. And remember, time and money are going to be convenient excuses for everybody. I'm trying to save you money, and this will save you time in the sense that you can literally do it whenever you want. I'm going to hard sell you guys on this because I get hundreds of emails, as is my team, every year asking when these things are going to go on sale. Are there any group discounts? We're answering your question, but you only got a few more days. So go and use it now. artofcoaching.com/courses, Black Friday 30. All right. Aside from that, I also made a promise to you guys from the very beginning that I would never endorse a product I don't actually use. And I want to hold that promise. And I'm really anxious to welcome a new member of our family. And you heard it on the last podcast, Element. Element is a tasty electrolyte drink mix that contains all the things you need and nothing of what you don't. Zero sugar, all natural ingredients. If you need something that's gluten-free, paleo, keto-friendly, all these things, you have that in Element. Now, why do I use it? Guys, I traveled 94,000 miles this year speaking alone. And when I speak, I get dehydrated very easily. I'm also the warmest person alive. I know this might gross you out. I'm a pretty heavy sweater. I have to have that kind of support nutritionally. So Element is something that I love because it's not sweet and overbearing. It's not loaded with a bunch of prebiotics that make my stomach, you know, upset right before I'm about to jump on stage or jump on the podcast. It is critical for me. Go to drinkelement, that's LMNT.com/AOC for Art of Coaching. Again, that's drinkelement.com/AOC, and you can get your free sample pack today. Check it all out in the show notes. We made that link very easy. Okay, now let's get to today's episode. Welcome to the Art of Coaching Podcast, a show aimed at getting to the core of what it takes to change attitudes, behaviors, and outcomes in the weight room, boardroom, classroom, and everywhere in between. I'm your host, Brett Bartholomew. I'm a performance coach, keynote speaker, and the author of the book, Conscious Coaching. But most importantly, I'm a lifelong student interested in all aspects of human behavior and communication. I want to thank you for joining me, and now let's dive into today's episode. If you're somebody that you feel like, hey, I'm trying to find my voice, or how do I deal with unsolicited advice, or you've ever felt like, man, I don't get the feedback that I'd like as a communicator, as a professional, today's guest can relate to that. And she's got great tips for you. And most importantly, she comes from a place that this advice just hits a little bit different, because she works for one of the largest entertainment companies in the world, ESPN. Steffi Sorensen is a former women's basketball player at Florida. She joined ESPN in 2011 as a color commentator and is now a college basketball analyst and sideline reporter for the SEC Network. She joined SEC Now as an analyst for the 2019-2020 women's basketball season. She was also a sideline reporter for college football games on Fox Sports. She's been a fitness model and a trainer, and she even spent 1 year playing professional basketball in France before starting as a color analyst for ESPN3 in 2010. And we get into a lot of things here. I mean, it's fascinating to me how she learned to become a better communicator. I mean, you have to imagine and you have to understand that she literally has to interview people during some of the most enigmatic moments of their life. Did they miss the game-winning shot? Did they make the game-winning shot? How does she manage the emotions of those that she speaks to? How does she manage her own emotions? Things that are tricky and not always talked about. We don't always get a lot of tips here. So I'm very excited to bring you this episode. She's very candid. And always, guys, as always, remember, these are unscripted and we don't censor people. We want people to be their authentic selves here. So as we say before, if foul language of any kind, and no matter how you define that, offends you, be discerning about who's in the car. We don't want to edit people. We believe people should have the right to express themselves. We're never going to be bombastic here for, you know, just throwing caution to the wind. But there is language in this episode, and you should always consider that for every episode. Most importantly, get your notebooks ready, lock and load, because Steffi Sorensen is coming up now. Hey guys, welcome back to the Art of Coaching podcast. I am here with Steffi Sorensen. Steffi, welcome to the show.
Brett, thanks so much for having me. It's good to be here with you.
Yeah, my pleasure. Listen, to give audience to those of you, to give context to those of you listening, Steffi and I first met when I was down at the RAC Athletic Performance Center training two of my NFL guys. And I see Steffi, who I did not know at the time, on the other end of the gym, just going blitzkrieg style through about every exercise imaginable. And I think that person over there has some drive, some intensity, and maybe some demons, and I want to meet her. And that was my first take on you. And then I remember you had come over and asked me a question about something. I think it was speed training. Do you remember this?
Yeah, it was some sort of technique or form, and I knew who you were, so I was like, he's the right guy to ask.
Oh, yeah. Making me look good in front of my audience. You had no clue who I was. You're like, you're some bearded weirdo training these guys.
No, that's not true. I'd been following you and like your style of coaching and the communication aspect. I actually I knew of someone who worked with you on the women's side. You're one of your employees. So I was very familiar. So it was strategic, Brett. You didn't know it at the time, but it was a way to, hey, let me get myself in here.
I did not know that. Well, listen, this is a big reason why we have you on the show today. As I got to learn more and more about you and your background and everything that you've done in your career and the strategic nature in which you've navigated personal and professional challenges, you're ideal for our audience, right? The people listening, as I told you off the air, we're all kind of these underdogs. We're all these people who feel like we're not the perfect fit to be a leader, or at least that's what society has kind of told us. But in reality, you know, people that are trying to make the most of what they've gone through and their experiences to help others in an area or a world that's really not black and white, it's gray. And so if you wouldn't mind just giving our audience a brief synopsis of who you are, what you do, and why the hell you do that.
Well, Brett, it's funny that your description of when you saw me at the gym, it's so accurate, because I'm a walking oxymoron. I really am. Look, when I went to the University of Florida, I didn't get into broadcasting school. I now work as a broadcaster for ESPN. That in itself shouldn't have happened, right? The only B I got my freshman year of college was in public speaking. I now speak for a living. That doesn't make much sense either, right? And, you know, just throughout my life, there's been a lot of doubting. There's been a lot of overcoming. And I think that that's just kind of paved my way and made me who I am. I'm full-time college basketball analyst for ESPN. That's what I do seasonally. In my off season, I've been through hell for the past 3 years. And I've fortunately have had a job that has given me some flexibility that I could tend to that. And we'll get into that in the podcast, but a lot of perseverance I've learned about myself, and some of that goes way back into my journey. So yes, you saw some demons, but that's, I got to exercise those and get them out, because that is my form of training in it. That is how I function as a human. If I don't do that, that's, you know, like, I'm not the same.
Yeah. So, listen, I understand that for sure. And exercising your demons, a little bit of a play on words with that, given how intensely I saw you train. I do want to ask this, not to butt in too early, but just given the obvious, right? And you're the second member of ESPN to be featured on this show, by the way. Your colleague or Mike Golick has been on it, because I used to coach Mike. But when you mentioned that you're, you know, in a way, right, like you had gotten into public speaking and you essentially speak for a living now, I have to ask this, has that always come easy to you? And the reason I ask this, Steffi, is we get a lot of people that say, hey, what kind of people gravitate to your workshops or what you do at Art of Coaching? Are they always extroverted? Are they always this? I mean, would you classify yourself as somebody that's, yeah, I've always had an easy time with communication, I've always been extroverted, or does that not fit you?
Brett, I'm an introvert through and through. You know, I'm a shy person. I'm awkward, goofy. I mean, you name it. See, the reason why I went up to you at the gym is like, I'm comfortable at the gym because like sports, fitness, like all of that, like I'm comfortable there. So like, I felt okay. I felt safe to go up and talk to you. You know what I mean? But outside of those realms, I'm definitely like a shy person. I'm more introverted, and it's not in my norm to be a public speaker. I just had a passion for basketball because I played it my whole life. It gave me a life, and it's a form of like giving back, you know, like for just covering the sport. You know, Brett, people ask me all the time, Steffi, why do you want to do the NFL? And I'm like, I don't want to do the NFL. Why don't you want to be on Monday Night Football? You'd be this and this and this. Everyone projects like what I should be. And I've never wanted to be anything other than me. And I love covering college basketball because it's, you know, the very thing that I loved. And so I'm sure we'll get off topic a little bit on this podcast, but basically if I were to give myself a grade in public speaking now, I would be at a C. That's why I'm here with you today, because I need to get some help with you.
Yeah. Well, I think you could definitely give me a lot of pointers. I have to ask this though, within that, and you mentioned your passion for basketball, and I love that you don't let what other people project and say that you should do dictate that, because really, you know, this people so often will say, okay, there's this thing they want to do, but they're going to throw it on you. Right. And I had this in my own career as well. Why wouldn't you take this job? Why wouldn't you take that job? I'm like, that's a job you want by all means. Right. But like, we all have different lives within that though. If you're an introvert, yet your job is still to extract information from people and give insight and give context and kind of shape this environment. What do you do when there's folks that you're trying to talk to or speak with that don't really open up so well, right? They feel guarded, or you're looking for, you know, more than a sound bite, and you kind of have to work for it, and you have these intense time constraints. Can you give us an example? Or if that doesn't make sense, I'm happy to clarify.
Well, look, I work in live television, and a lot of things that I do, especially like after a big game and you're dealing with a player and I've got three lights coming and a camera and we run over to them, they freeze up. And a lot of time it's on me. I will make the interview, like, you know, I have to steer it. And so if I ask a question and the player goes, yeah, and you're not prepared to follow up with another question. So I think what I do, and this is more, not necessarily verbal, but it's a physical cue, is I'll put my hand on their back and give them a tap and kind of bring them closer to me. And it seems to relax a player or a coach and to know that like, they're good, you know, like maybe hit them with a little joke or something just before we come on camera and they're good to go. I mean, and you know this from the interactions with athletes now, they're prime. They've been coming out of high school. They got cameras all in their face. They're TikToking all day. Like they're used to, you know, being in a space where cameras are on them. So, but it still is a challenge. Every time I interview someone, you got to be able to weave in and out of awkward conversations, but making people feel comfortable. And I think that's my role as a commentator and as a reporter.
Yeah, well, I think about that and I appreciate the specific example. And we talk about that in our workshops. What you use there is a form of haptics. When we grade people and their speaking or communication, right? Do they utilize touch, right? And then kinesics, what we usually reference as body language, right? Am I scowling? Am I smiling? All those pieces. And so you're right. Touch is therapeutic. And I think about it all the time of even, you know, you're in Florida as we're having this conversation. I'm in Atlanta. It's so different even having these conversations over Zoom, right? Like I'd love nothing more than for you to be here. And we get that. Talk about projecting. People say, hey, why don't you have your guests come out to you? You know, Joe Rogan and them do that. I'm like, okay, well, it's a little bit different, you know, but, and it also does take a little bit more conversational skill on your end and my end to facilitate this when we have this electronic barrier, right? Like you can't relax somebody. And sometimes it's hard to kind of place that hand on their back or anything. And so, but I think you bring up another interesting point that today's athletes are different in that they're used to these cameras in their face. And that's something I wouldn't have even thought about when you think about, all right, well, how did this compare to 1989 or this year or that year? I mean, the reality is sometimes it's still hard for people in the moment to make sense of their emotions, but it sounds like you're able to calm them a little bit. Do you get formal training on that being a part of ESPN, or is this something that you've just had to refine on your own over the years?
I've had to refine it on my own. You know, ESPN was my first job. I just shared with you when we opened up this podcast, like I didn't get into broadcasting school. Like I went a different way. I went into like business management. I was like, I'm never going to work in media. You know, I was always really good with media, like just throughout my career. I became like the spokesperson for our team. I was just kind of naturally good with it. But so I didn't know what to expect. And then, you know, ESPN wanted former athletes. They were kind of steering away from what they had been hiring, and they wanted former athletes, just maybe people who had been in those positions. And so like 2011, 2012 was like, I sat down to do a game and the light came on. That was it. There was no training. And since then I've had to learn all of my mistakes on national television. You know, that's the advantage. When I talk to a lot of students that are in broadcasting school, like they're already doing games like in college. Like they're like 3 or 4 years ahead of like where I was when I got into broadcasting. Like their mistakes come on tape. Mine come on when there's a huge audience and it's just like, I look stupid. So it's just like trial by fire. You get in, I'm stuttering over a question and the coach is looking at me. Like those are mistakes that I had to make and just learn from. But I always read out, my biggest thing was if someone just coached me or told me, I would never make the same mistake twice. And that's something I've always prided my career on. Help me in these moments. What do I need to do differently? And I won't do it again. And that's kind of been the story of how I've kind of elevated throughout my career.
Well, and it seems like too, you being willing to make those mistakes, which sounds so obvious, sounds so common sense, but we see it time and time again, whether it's in coach development, leadership development, most people don't even go and get training on any of this. And then unlike you, they're also not willing to put themselves in those positions. So they can read leadership books. They can read communication books. They can do all these things, but they're never willing to do that. I mean, we even see that at our workshops where we utilize improv and role playing. And, you know, generally the people that come to these workshops are not the ones who need to the most. Like, yes, they need practice and refinement like all of us do. Right. But there's people out there that think they're already great communicators, that they're already great at these things, yet they'd never go. They'd never do what you did. They'd never open themselves up to training. And so then they go through life kind of just tone deaf, for lack of a better term, to like where they might be the problem in a lot of their social interactions. And I'm building that off of, you know, a long-winded one here, but you mentioned being willing to make mistakes. You mentioned work ethic. You went to, if I recall, 3 different schools. You mentioned you were denied entry into broadcasting school. What has driven the resilience, your mindset, your willingness to make mistakes, just this hustle? Like, what is it in your past that most people don't continue to go from here to here to here to here? They lose faith at some point. You seem not to have.
It's a good question. And as the older I've gotten, I've leaned on my mom a lot and asking her, like, why am I the way I am? You know, like, why is it that, you know, I stopped here and instead of doing this, like I did this, why did I not why did I always believe that? Like, I remember when I was in junior college, and I know I'm like the quintessential like transfer queen, like before it became popular. Three schools in 4 years. Like, I can't say anything about transferring because I did it a lot. But, you know, I was in junior college and it was in Gainesville, and I would go and watch Florida play. And I was like, damn, I was like, I feel like I can play with them. I really do. Like, it's something internal. And my mom said that growing up from a very young age, she's like, you just had this determination, whatever you were doing. And I do have an older brother. She's like, I just could see it in your eyes. If you want to get that ball, it was up here or whatever, you would find out whatever way to do it. It was just like a determination at a very young age. And I think that that's just, I don't know, and you can answer this, Brett, is if you think that someone is just kind of born with those qualities, because we can argue all day on leaders, born leader, build into a leader, you know, but the determination aspect is just, I've always been that way. That's all I know. And so throughout my career, it was just like, it was a no-brainer to me, because the only person who's going to believe in me is me. And I can never waver on that.
No, 100%. I mean, you're right about the first thing, without a doubt, these things that are inside of us that kind of subconsciously determine or influence our behavior. It's now I'm biased, admittedly, because anybody that's listening that has gone to artofcoaching.com, what drives you? We have this quiz, and one of the drives that you're referencing is adversity, you know, and this is a drive that is part of me as well. Now, of course, nobody's ever one drive their life. Like there's adversity, there's achievement. There's some that are more unity focused and they like bonding with others and security focused where they have to have plans and they're pretty risk averse. Those that are adversity driven primarily, right? They like having their backs up against the wall. They tend to also be very curious individuals. They're people that are just compelled by challenges. And we find that a lot of them too are very self-competitive. It's not even just like how competitive they are with other people. Like the ones that tend to stave off burnout or just flame out early are the ones that are most self-competitive, right? Because you run somebody else's race and that gets tricky. And I think it also makes sense because I remember you saying the last 3 to 4 years have been hell for you. I mean, this seems to be inveterate in your family. If I remember correctly, your mom in around April 2018 had Guillain-Barré syndrome. Your brother Eric nearly lost his life in 2020. I mean, it sounds like your whole family is one big adversity drive because what they went through. And I obviously don't want to get too personal if you're not comfortable sharing those things, but do those experiences, not just the ones you had transferring and this and that in your athletic career, do they feed into that? And what has that taught you about how to communicate with others during times of hardship as well, for that matter?
Yeah. I mean, you know, when my mom got sick, my mom's definitely the rock of our family. And Guillain-Barré is such an interesting illness in that she was completely paralyzed, Brett, for a year. So she had to relearn how to eat, drink, talk, sit, walk, the whole nine.
A year.
Perfectly fine, but she was on a ventilator for 3 months, couldn't talk. Then she spent the next year relearning how just to sit in a chair. I mean, it was like the most unreal thing I'd ever witnessed. And she was so determined. I mean, she was like honored by the hospital that she rehabbed at because they had never seen anyone recover like that. So I definitely feel like got a little of the mom gene in me, you know, just the fight, right? Fighting for her life. And just as she was getting better, my brother had a freak accident and he fell in my parents' kitchen. Brother's a big guy, 6'4", 6'5". So you're naturally kind of a fall risk, that being that tall. And he just landed awkwardly on the back of his head. And they had to life flight him. And it was like, you know, I was actually in Orlando doing a basketball game for CBS. And I got the call from my dad and just 120 miles an hour, 2 hours up the road to get to Jacksonville. And, you know, my whole family was in the waiting room. We didn't know if he was going to make it. They were, you know how it is in hospital. It's very doom and gloom.
Yeah. Oh, for sure.
I think, you know, I shared personally, it took me a while to share it personally, but it was more like 80-20, like 80 not going to make it. And that was about like six months, like after my mom finally was like up and moving and like good. And like, he went to the same rehab hospital she did, you know, like it was just like, I couldn't believe I was like back in the ICU. I cannot believe this. And, you know, my sister was pregnant again. So she was pregnant during my mom's sickness, pregnant during my brother's fall, bless her heart, pregnant and going through all this. And, my dad is, you know, I'm going through the family tree here, Brett, just work with me here. Yeah. But my dad definitely was my brother's only son. It hit him really hard. And we just, you know, we had to stick by him really close. You know, he's got his own demons and all of that. And it was, you know, there's some things that, you know, that are a little bit too personal, but that we had to fight for him with. So it was like all of my family all at one time. It was just like, I was like thrown into this position to basically become like the matriarch and patriarch at the same time, like having to communicate with everyone in the family every day who came to the ICU, because like my mom and dad, like they could barely like function. So it was like me that would meet everyone at the hospital and like give them the full rundown of like basically like what's wrong with my brother. And it was like, I never would have thought, like, just because I was in a broadcaster doesn't mean like you can deliver, like, today we don't know if he's going to make it, you know, to 25 family members. And it was just like, I don't know if I got a tattoo that I was talking to my mom one day. I was giving her a shower and I said that there's one thing that's come of this. And I said, I feel like I'm built for this life.
Yeah.
Weirdly, I don't want this life, but I feel like I'm built for this. It threw me into this weird position to just command everyone and lead everyone at a time where it was rocky, and learned a lot about myself. I had no idea I was capable of that. And I don't, you know, I don't want to say like I would ever want to do it again, but, you know, through those hardships, I knew life was hard, you know, things in sports, you lose, whatever, like you go through stuff like that and you're like, this is hard. And this really carves out who you are as a person. And I'm just like, I'm thankful along the way that like I've been able to become a better person because of it.
Yeah. Well, you touch on two things I want to hit, but I mean, just to recap, because it's insane. I mean, first of all, before I get to the question, so what your mom was diagnosed with, and how did you pronounce it? Guillain-Barré?
Guillain-Barré.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that's an autoimmune disorder?
Yes.
Okay. And so literally like she was paralyzed. Is she still paralyzed?
No.
Okay. So she was able to recover for that. And then your brother and maybe our research is wrong on this, but I remember something you saying, like, they were handed a pamphlet saying that your brother was going to be, it was about how to manage somebody who is in a vegetative state.
You better believe I try to get her fired too.
Yeah. Well, I think the reason like that I bring that up is, you know, this is near and dear to some of the stuff that we're doing. In the sense that, and I'll send you this article off air, but you've got to read it. There was this article called "When Your Doctor Gets It and Gets You: The Critical Role of Competence and Warmth in Patient-Provider Interaction." And you know, when I was working on part of my doctorate, we had learned that, you know, there's like $12 billion lost, I think, in like 2015 in the medical world, just in the U.S. alone, based on poor communication, lawsuits, all these things. And not only that, so many people don't. Doctors don't get training on the art of delivering bad news. And so, which is a big reason why we started utilizing improv and role-playing. And then we found out through more research that now there are certain universities like Northwestern and others that they are making doctors, they are making medical staff go through these. So imagine me and my colleague Allie's frustration when we would hear some coaches be like, I don't need to go do communication training. I don't need to do this. Yet people that are literally having to give life and death serious, you know, they're willing to go role play. They're willing to do this. They're willing to do the pretend. And yet still look how far we have yet to go with that, right? For somebody to not even have the social intelligence to understand like, hey, maybe there's some decorum here of how I handle this, as opposed to here you go, person going through trauma. Here's a pamphlet without much context, without any warmth, on how to handle somebody that might end up in a vegetative state. Like, how do you even manage the anger, the frustration, that who the hell do you think you are that you feel in that moment?
So my mom was in the room with my brother when I guess a doctor walked in and didn't say much, but handed her the pamphlet. And you think about now knowing a little bit about my mom, and she's looking at that and she's like, no, the hell he's not, you know, and who are you to come give me this pamphlet? And so when I walked in, and she was in tears, of course, if you have a doctor that comes in, doesn't say anything, and then hands you, your son's going to be in a vegetative state and how to manage that, you know, what do you think? And so she was just in tears, and I just took it. I ripped it up. I threw it out. I knew the guy that was running the hospital. I called him. Needless to say, we got an apology and an explanation in a few hours.
But I'd love to know what that explanation was sometime. I was just like,
yes, yeah. This is what it was. You know, and I've had a lot of interactions, some good, some bad with medical, and I'm not here to bash anyone, but it's definitely, I think that is so great that you're taking that on, because talk about a difficult job, you know, like you've got to deliver some of the toughest news, heartbreaking news that people are on pins and needles on. And I'm sure that like very few are actually equipped, you know, to actually and naturally do that in an effective way, in a way that like comforts people, but you've got to do it every day, all day. So that's great that that's something that you're getting into, because boy, do they need it.
Well, it's just, it's been interesting. Right. And I think, you know, again, full bias, like I nearly lost my life in part due to poor communication in the medical world. Right. I was seen as kind of this, I was treated with kind of a one size fits all approach. And I know, again, my colleague, Allie Kirshner, you know, her partner lives in this world where she's got to deliver some, I mean, horrendous news to expectant mothers and other individuals. And you're right. You know, if we're giving grace to the other side, you know, it does say, and I'm quoting some research here, for example, both adults and children form evaluations of another person's warmth and competence after just 100 milliseconds exposure to a person's face. So, you know, there are some things that are almost out of our control in terms of how somebody perceives the way we interact or feel about somebody. And then some medical professionals are put into even more of a tough situation where I think they said, because of how overwhelmed the healthcare system is, at least in the United States, on average, doctors and nurses can only get maybe 7 to 10 minutes with a patient, right? And so that's hard to win somebody over that quickly. But at the same point, there has to be some kind of evaluation. There has to be these things. And so when we went and looked at them, because we have an evaluation at our workshop, and I'm like, well, surely the medical world has something better and I can learn from it. But I mean, you still wouldn't believe it, Steffi. It's like, they're grading medical professionals on, are they skilled communicators by this questionnaire? And I think it's called the Segway. I'd have to look at it again, but it's, did you ask the patient's name? Yes or no. Did you ask them something else about what's going on other than their malady or their illness? Yes or no. No, you cannot. Yes or no. Human. Yeah. Hey, Steffi here. Are you glad you won the game? Yes. How do you feel? Yes. So I just feel like you're a natural with that. And with that, you know, you said this is not the life or the role that I wanted, but it's the one that I feel like I can do, I'm built for. I think that also speaks to a lot of listeners where being somebody who cares so much, you're an underdog, you're empathetic, you're adversity driven. You can be somebody that tends to take the world on their shoulders. How do you manage that and also not getting burnout? How do you manage this kind of, you know, if you'll allow me to use the analogy, work and rest the same way you do in the gym? Because I have to imagine you put a lot of pressure on yourself, especially during that moment.
I don't know. That's a good question, Brett. I think about it a lot, just given the last few years, is like, maybe I just don't pay attention or give myself enough. Like I'm all about other people. And so like, I don't take the time maybe to reflect on like, how am I doing? Yeah. You know, that's why, like, you probably saw me train, like, that's my way of giving back to me. And maybe that's crazy, but like, that's just kind of how I'm wired. You know, like if I get an hour and a half to myself, I'm just going for it. Like that's, I'm not getting burnt out because like, that's what's giving me life. So, I'm still working on that. And I think that's probably a good question for a lot of people that manage stuff like that, is just, how do you take care of yourself?
Yeah. Well, I mean, especially when you have to shoulder that much, right? Cause stress compounds, and it's not just, oh, I'm busy. But when you have family stuff going on, you have work going on, you have your own things, these things compound. And I think that it's just something that I know a lot of our listeners say they struggle with, is sometimes they think they're giving back to themselves, but really they're so, they don't ever want to seem selfish, or there's so many other things going on and they feel like, well, there's so many other people that have it worse. And I always try to say, well, listen, you know, this isn't, it doesn't have to be the struggling Olympics, right? Eventually we know through the burnout research that the people that are most dedicated are the ones that tend to burn out. And so I just thought like, you know, where, let's pivot this. Where are you still the hardest on yourself, either personally or professionally? And how do you balance that with some sense of like grace? So you mentioned it earlier, you know, there's times where you made mistakes on the air, but you're also somebody that's like, yeah, I was never taught this. So if you just give me a second chance, I'm good. In a world of people that feel like they've got to get it right once or they're screwed, are there other areas where you're still kind of trying to give yourself some grace that maybe you think they could still relate to?
I think what I've learned professionally and in terms of what I do as a sports broadcaster is in the moment, let's say there was a couple times in a few previous seasons, big game, sellout, and maybe I'm calling a game or I'm rushing to the court to interview a coach. And it doesn't feel good. The interview doesn't feel good, or what I said didn't feel good. And I watch it back and I have come to the realization, and I've applied this across the board, is it's never as bad as it seems. It's never as bad as you think it was. I can go back and go, it wasn't that bad. And then you move on. Okay. Like, it's not that bad when you think about it. So I think that was a couple years ago. It took me a long time to get there, to have like the maturity and growth to watch it back, you know, with an open mind and being like, okay, like, I don't suck, you know, like, you can just totally criticize yourself, but you have to have a little bit of grace. You're on the fly. You're calling the game as is. And, I think that's just kind of been my takeaway, is like, it's never as bad as it seems. Life, sports, you know, whatever it is that you're facing. That's kind of just been my approach. Hopefully that answered your question.
Yeah, absolutely. And I say it, and I reflect on the things that I still do. And my wife and I were talking about this as well. You know, I teach now communication and interpersonal skills for a living. And so it can be really easy for us to just crush ourselves on everything. Like, there was a staff miscommunication the other day that led to there was an appointment that we had a coaching call and a miscommunication. So we missed the call. And I said, I go, this is so ridiculous. And I started beating myself up. I'm like, I run a company that teaches people how to communicate during the most impactful times in their life. Yet a miscommunication just costs us the trust and respect in the business of a potential client. And I'll just start going and going and going. And then I'm like, listen, like, just because you teach these things doesn't mean you're infallible, right? Just because I'm a professional baseball player doesn't mean I don't strike out. But, you know, you have to give yourself grace, because sometimes the world just won't, because it is a world of spectators by and large, right? There's not always people that are dedicated to kind of sanding the rough edges of their own craft, because the people that are most self-aware are the people like you, Steffi, who are out there. You see yourself on camera. You'll have to hear the tone of your voice again. And I don't know if you're anything like me, but when I hear myself or I see myself, I cringe all the time. I mean, do you enjoy seeing yourself on camera?
I have had to get over it.
Yeah.
You have to get better at your craft, and by getting better at your craft, you have to hear what you're saying. And so I think for most people, they hear their voice like on a video that they took on their iPhone or whatever, and they're like, oh God, my voice. And you know, my voice is what dictates my paycheck. So my voice needs to basically be on point. What I'm saying, how I'm saying it, I've had to learn how to deepen my voice. There's a lot of, what's the word I'm looking for?
Tonality.
Yeah, that, and just training myself based off of other people that I hear that are good. You know, Doris Burke, Sage Steele, there's a ton that come to mind, and their voice is everything. And that's kind of the nature of our business that people, I think, sometimes forget about, because they just hear us, but you don't want to hear someone who's annoying.
No.
You don't want to ever get muted, you know?
Yeah.
I don't want to be muted.
Hey, once again, quick reminder, if you're enjoying this, if you enjoy hearing about communication and feedback and managing your career, take advantage of our 30% off for the last few days at artofcoaching.com/courses. Go there now, whether you're trying to get a better hold on burnout, your career, trying to figure out who your audience is, how you can impact them more, how to become a better communicator, how to better understand people. All of those things are covered in our courses, and it's only a few more days where you're going to be able to get them for 30% off. And reminder, strength coaches, these are CEU approved, bought in, will give you 1.8 CEUs. That's artofcoaching.com/courses, and just enter the code BLACKFRIDAY30, that's 30, at checkout to save all that cash. All right, back to Steffi.
You know, Doris Burke, Sage Steele, there's, you know, there's a ton that come to mind, and their voice is everything. And that's kind of the nature of our business that people, I think, sometimes forget about because they just hear us, but you don't want to hear someone who's annoying.
No.
You don't want to ever get muted, you know?
Yeah.
I don't want to be muted.
Well, and this is where, and I hope you'll nerd out with me to a degree because our audience loves this stuff, right? But that's why it surprised me when you had said, yeah, no, there's no formal training, you know, or, you know, for us, even just thinking about like, we have a, I don't know what it's up to now because we just redid it, but it's like a 24-point scale on our evaluation. And we kind of hinted at it in our last episode. But for example, let's say I was, let's say you were evaluating me, you're my boss at ESPN and I'm an analyst and I'm on the road and I'm doing a broadcast. We'll evaluate folks at our workshop on clarity, conciseness, fluency, tonality, tempo. We will look at, from a nonverbal standpoint, haptics, use of touch, kinesics, overall body language. Are you smiling? Are you frowning? Proxemics, how far you're spaced from that individual. Your use of empathy during a conversation. So there's really nothing like that you've ever gone through. I mean, because I've watched you. I've gone back and watched broadcasts. I've watched clips of it. I mean, you're incredible. And to hear that you haven't had training or any kind of review on that, I mean, it's amazing. Are these things that, so they don't even get talked about at like a year-end review or when people go through your evaluation, they just expect you to like, you either got it or you don't.
Basically, if you get a call back to come, you know, it varies on people's deals, you know, like if you have a 1 year, 2 year, 3 year or whatever. If you don't hear anything, that means you're doing good.
What?
Which is it is so strange. And it has been, you know, I just worked a lot the past few seasons with Andy Landers. He's a Hall of Famer. He was a coach at Georgia. And his thing with me was he called me when he first got in the business. He said, "Steph, nobody says anything to me." And I was like, "What do you mean?" He's like, "No one will criticize me." He said, "I need you to watch my game and tell me how I'm doing." So I watched it and I was like, "You talk way too damn much." And he was like, "No one will say that to him." And so this profession, what is expected versus like the feedback, I think I've had feedback like once every 4 years.
What?
And this round of negotiations for my new contract, I really sought it out. I was like, I really want to know, like, how do I become like better? I really want to be a, you know, like one of your best analysts, because I am like still young, but you know, something to strive towards. And they actually suggested like doing a little bit of improv and like, that's something.
Come on to our workshop.
We'll give you the VIP. I'm seriously considering it. Like
listen, you would not be the odd person out. We've had FBI agents. We've had folks in their 60s, folks in their 20s, folks. I mean, listen, it's for everything, right? And like that to me has been probably the biggest thing that I wanted in my career as well, right? Like I got to a point probably in 2014 where I knew I could write a program for athletes. I knew I could coach a session. I knew I could do these things, right? And I could sit here and go into the weeds like so many coaches in my profession did, where we want to argue the smallest nuance of every exercise. But by and large, you know, it was like I needed to feel like I was growing elsewhere. And like you, you know, we wouldn't really get that much feedback. You'd do your year-end reviews and people would say, "Oh, you know, Steffi, you're really dedicated, you know, but you know, sometimes you might come off too passionate," or "Steffi, hey, you know, we'd like to see you do this and that," but none of it was like craft related. It was always somebody's perception. Yeah. And so I remember, and I'm sorry for my audience that's heard this before, I'll keep it brief, but I remember asking I had 30 guys I was coaching. I said, "Why do you come to me?" It was almost like having a mini breakdown on the floor. And I kept bugging them. And they're, you know, the way you write workouts, the way you do this. I said, "Quit the shit. Like, why do you really come?" And one dude was like, "Man, it's just the way you coach and interact." So I remember like I shut up then. I mean, I coached the rest of the session and I was stuck in a layover in Denver. You're always stuck in a layover in like Denver or Minneapolis if you're traveling in the winter, right? And I just started writing down, why do I interact this way? Why do I speak that way? How do I alter my tone of voice? And I just started diving into this. And I'm like, it became clear to me that ironically, everything that I was doing as a coach tied back into the things that I wish somebody had done for me when I was in the hospital. Instead of just communicating in this monotone, soulless, lifeless, non-adaptable, one-size-fits-all way, you're the patient, you're sick, this is how it's going to be, I was hyper-aware of all the other pieces, which is also ironically why I think I'm a music buff and I'd know when a rapper switched their cadence or the beat, and you just start becoming attuned to these acoustics. So it is therapeutic to teach these things because knowing there's people like you that you could pay attention to the purposeful change in tonality, or you know when to smile on the other end of the interview. But how crazy is it that like you're at the one of the most massive entertainment communication-based companies in the world, and you only get feedback if something goes wrong?
Yeah. I mean, you see, you know, the Tony Romos are, that doesn't happen where he has no training. He
explain that just for any audience member that we have an international audience. So what do you mean? Like, what did he excel at?
Well, Tony Romo was the Dallas Cowboys quarterback. Yep. And he retired and took a job for CBS and makes about $17 million a year calling about 10 football games. But he jumped into the booth and was amazing at it right from the jump. And that is something you just can't teach. He just has that. He has that. Most other people have gone through some training, and especially for like former athletes, there's become more formal training. But it is kind of crazy to be in this business and you don't really hear anything. But I just wanted to, this is off topic, but Brett, the first time when we were at the gym and I heard your voice, that's how I knew who you were. So good job.
Yeah. Hey,
you
well,
got a great voice.
I appreciate it.
I heard it and I was like, I feel like that's Brett. And I know Brett from Instagram. Part of coaching. Cause I saw Golic Jr. Wearing your shirt on one of the shows.
It was when him and his dad were still doing Mike and Mike, you know, they were on that. And then he wore it a couple other times.
Yeah. He's what a good family.
Yeah. Well, good. Really good people, you know, within what you just mentioned and how he was able to seamlessly do that. I have to put you in. Are you cool going into a little hot seat scenario? I have a question for you.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh boy.
Now, this is something we're working on, so kind of half-baked. So if you don't really identify with any of them, just be like, nah, dude, this is trash. You can say that on the air. It's okay. But in teaching people and helping them like become more self-aware of what their communication styles and tendencies are, you know, one thing that we always say, and everybody loves them an acronym, is good communicators are rare, R-A-R-E. So what we find is, that, let's say we draw four squares, Steffi, okay, just basic kind of quadrants, and nobody's ever won. So there's no pressure for you to say one. I just want to know where you skew. So there's communication styles that are more realist centered, right? They're matter of fact. They're going to kind of tell it how it is. No bullshit, straightforward. They care about you. They're just not going to mince words. Okay. Then there's the analyst. The analyst is somebody that's very, you know, they're going to use a lot of logic-based appeals. They're going to always talk about data, statistics, or, you know, they might even be very introverted and in their own head, but everything's got to get broken down to the nth degree, right? Very kind of, this is how it is. This is what the data suggests, pop, pop, pop. Then we have relators. Think of the relator like a visionary. They're kind of life of the party. They can inspire a crowd, right? They're always getting everybody on board. They're very warm and engaging and fun to be around. Then we have, you know, true just empaths, people that are very, Steffi, how are you today? And how are you, you know, they want to know, it's so much of it is about the person, you know. Now to draw a clear distinction between an empath and a relator is usually trying to get people together for some kind of common goal, right? Or even if they're just in a moment where it's like, God, everybody's drawn to that person. They're magnetic in that way, even if they're not making it all about the individual they're talking to. So I'll repeat it. A realist, matter of fact, straightforward, no bullshit. Okay. Analyst, kind of cold, hard facts in their own head, very choosy with their words, usually very focused on logic, black and white type statements, the relator, life of the party, or they don't have to be. They could just be very warm and magnetic, visionary, or true empath. Hey, I just want to know how you're doing. Oh my gosh, that sounds crazy. You know, I'm using bad examples there, but just trying to highlight kind of the feel. Where would you say, if any of those, you tend to skew in your day-to-day life? And then how does that change during conflict?
Can you kind of hybrid
them? Oh, for sure. Like for example, when I'm interviewing, when we're having this conversation right now, my goal is to be more of the relator. I also want to be empath, right? So it's this dot, almost like if I'm trying to get a cat to chase a laser pointer, right? It's this dot. If the dot is you right now, it's always going to be skewing, right? If I have to go give a presentation at a university, I'll skew analysts and realists. You know, I might be relator at the beginning. So nobody's ever won. It changes. I'm just asking in general, like, what do you feel like? Yeah. If I'm having a backyard barbecue with some friends, or if you and I are talking off air, Brett, this is where I'd skew. What do you think?
I would say that I skew more towards like the realist, but also relator. So like kind of a hybrid between the two of them, because I've always looked at myself as like a social chameleon. It's like I can kind of go into different crowds and whatever I need. Not that I'm a poser, like I'm going to try and be
sure. No, we get it.
I walk into a group of these people, like, you know, I can morph into, let's talk about this. Or if you want to talk about this, let's talk about that. I try to stay up and be educated on everything, just so you never know who you're going to run into. It could be Brett Bartholomew at the rack, and I need to be on my A game on using bands.
See, what you use right there is what we call at our workshops an ingratiation tactic. So that's where you get somebody to open up by getting them in a good mood, and humor is always the best way. You know, as opposed to you go to a car lot when people use ingratiation poorly, and they're always like, "Oh, you look like a strapping young lad. You in the mood for a Jeep Wrangler?" You strike me as somebody, if we shift gears a little bit, you strike me as somebody that loves a good joke. You have a good sense of humor. And you said you're weird and you're quirky. I need to know one of the weirdest, like, what's one of the quirkiest things about you? Like, what is something that you're just like, that you view as goofy? Is it that you can remember movie quotes? Is it my wife trips all the time? You know, Allie, my colleague, will make like goofy voices sometimes when she gets confused. What is something that's kind of weird and quirky, but charming about you?
Definitely clumsy. Everyone calls me a klutz. You know, I had so many trips and falls growing up as a kid. They interviewed my dad to see if he was like physically harming me, because I was just always falling.
Oh, you know? Wow. What? Really?
I was like we were just talking about the story yesterday, and I guess like my brother threw a wooden swing and hit me in the face. So I was going to get stitches, and the like paramedics team like was pulled my dad aside. My dad was a firefighter, and so he's in his uniform, and they pulled him aside, and like he said they were talking to me, and I'm like, well, how old was I? He was like four. I'm like, well, what the hell did I say at four? Like, my daddy doesn't hit me, you know, like. So I think just I'm like natural. I don't know, I'm a little socially awkward, I think, but I can kind of it takes me a little bit to get comfortable, but when I do, I feel like I'm very personable. That's probably like a skill that I've learned to really hone in on, is especially working in media, is you have to build all these relationships with coaches, and then you got to trash them on air. But it's like, if you can be personable and find ways to weave like some humor in, you know, when you're talking to these coaches, you're interviewing them for the games, leading up to a game, and you want to get insight from them, but you know, you're going to be critical. You know, there's a fine line in how you can, you know, make your personality work. And that's been probably one of the biggest challenges for me, is finding your personality in television. There's some people that just are naturally just so good on camera. And it's like, that's been a little bit harder for me, because my personality is a little bit more intense, Brett. I mean, you kind of saw one side of me, but that's what made me good as an athlete. It's made me, I feel like, achieve in life. And it's like, how do you tone that down, or how do you become less intense? Like, Pat Summitt was my idol. And why? But she was also like, the stories always hear after is like how kind and sweet she was, in addition to being like such so stone cold. And so finding like a blend of like a personality and then portraying it on television is very, very difficult. That's why still learning. Still, every day you learn in this business.
Well, that was something I was going to ask you, you know, to a degree you have to bake with the flour you have. And if you're a naturally intense person and an adversity drive, you know, I guess I'm going to ask you, and I, as always, I'll clarify if I ask this poorly, have you found that ever worked against you? In one of my reviews, I would always get told, oh, you're kind of intense, or you can kind of come off intimidating. And in my mind, I was just, listen, I have a strong purpose and I have conviction. And most importantly, like after nearly losing my life at a young age, I have a lot of urgency. I have a lot of urgency. And I always felt sometimes, and I wasn't mature enough to take that criticism for what it was then, but I felt like this says a lot about the other person. Like, why is this person complaining that I'm intense all the time or I'm intimidating? I don't do anything threatening to them overtly. If they're just intimidated by my demeanor, screw them is what I thought. Now, of course, I've grown since then. There's still some things that you feel like can be frustrating with that, but have you ever had that? Have you ever had somebody use your intent, act like, oh, you got a chip on your shoulder, or you better calm it down, or anything like that?
Definitely in the sports broadcasting world is the number one criticism that I get the most is, we want you to have more fun.
You're like, am I not having fun?
Well, I might be having fun, but what my fun looks like may not come across as fun. Or it's just, you might just be a little bit more on the intense side, as opposed to the more like light and fluffy. I've never been light and fluffy. And you know, I've talked to my boss about that, and you know, I just got to be me, but you can work, you know, on some of those things and kind of adjusting a little bit to being just more, more, not necessarily likable, but just, you know, relatable, because people want to watch someone that they can relate to a little bit. So.
Yeah. Well, and I remember when your boss reached out to me and said, hey, you know, when you asked Steffi that question, you know, just make sure she knows that we viewed her as intense, because at halftime she's burning ants. And that just seems, you know, really intimate. that seems really intense. Well, when you say you talk to your boss about that and you address it, that brings me up to, and only two more questions, and then you're off the hot seat. That's asserting yourself, right? And there's this idea sometimes, and we're going to do a whole standalone episode on this, but there's this feeling sometimes in our world where people think asserting yourself means you're aggressive, or, you know, you have to assert yourself in this way. But like it takes a long time for people to learn how to do that. I know in some respects I'm still learning. What age were you when you felt like you really became comfortable asserting yourself? And what was it that made you, what got you there, right? What does even comfortable asserting yourself mean? What does it look like for you?
I was 30. And I think, you know, as a female and I am pretty much, you know, male dominated industry, you get a lot of unsolicited advice and how I should do and be as a broadcaster, I did college football for a few years for Fox, and I did not like how I was treated in that regard. You're a prop. And I can't do that. That's not me. That's not my style. That's not my vibe. We're talking for 45 minutes. You can already pick up, like, that's not me. No. So, there was a person that told me that I would be better if I smiled more.
Ooh.
And he's much older, much more accomplished. And I stood up to him and basically just said, am I allowed to say anything? Like, am I allowed to say whatever?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It's unedited.
Basically like, fuck off.
Yeah.
And it took me 10 years, I would say 8 to 10 years to get the nerve, because I'd gotten that for like years. You know, you got guys coming up to you and telling you what to dress, you know, what I should wear and how I should speak. I need to look this way. You need to look that way. And I finally was like, fuck you.
Yeah.
And that was at 30. And since then I can handle calls with my boss. Well, what do you mean? Well, how can I do this better? Or what are you looking for then? If this is what you're saying, but like, this is how I'm projecting or, you know, whatnot. But that was a big moment for me in my career, is to just stand up and finally like find your voice and use it. And so I tried to, especially like young females that reach out to me that want to get into TV. And I'm like, there's going to come a time. And fortunately, like more women are more empowered now, where they're like, they don't really tolerate it.
Yeah.
but it wasn't like that. Even though it was just 4 or 5 years ago. So that's kind of, hopefully that is.
Yeah, I know that. I think that's super helpful. I mean, sometimes the answer is just that simple, you know, and I do have a follow-up question off that. So I lied about the number of questions, but I think about, you know, the obvious one there is, you know, you mentioned sometimes that unsolicited advice from men, but I'd have to imagine even with other females, that's got to be really competitive, is it not? I mean, that's got to come. I see your facial expression, so I feel like there's something there. Run with it.
I've gotten advice from women too. A lot of women, a couple that have steered me to try and get out of the business because I was a threat.
Yep.
So the concept of like men versus women, it's like women versus women. I mean, especially more competitive women versus women. Mm. It's like everyone out for themselves. I personally, like, my philosophy when it comes to like this business is like, if you're better than me, then you'll go ahead of me.
Yep.
Like, but I would never steer anyone or not help someone because I didn't want them to like overstep me. And I feel like, I've seen it where people have tried to do that to me to try and get me out of the broadcasting industry because maybe I would take their job. So I definitely do not approach that. And especially with young kids coming up, is like, it's just like basketball. It's like, I'm going to do everything I can, maybe off camera, to assist you or, you know, talk about this camera angle or whatever and feed that to you. If that makes TV look better, like we're a team. At the end of the day, like if you're better than me in 5 years and you cross up, cool. It's just like, I'm not going to do people dirty like that because people have done that to me and it's not cool.
Yeah. Well, something that comes up, and I appreciate you going there, is I've always felt like even though now I'm not just a strength and conditioning coach, I always felt like there were a lot of strength coaches that did that. What I mean is you'd look on YouTube or you look on the internet of coaches that would put advice for young coaches out there, and it was disguised as well-intentioned, and maybe in some cases it was, but it was essentially get your degree, get an internship, get certified, and you're good, which was just such a load of bullshit because there's so much more to, you know, you have so many coaches that get into the field and, you know, they get into these positions where now they're in real dire financial situations. They've checked those boxes, but they don't realize there's a completely different game to be played. And then they're constantly gaslit more and more, told, oh, by the way, you shouldn't worry about the money. Oh, by the way, you should never worry about yourself. It's not about you. You're a servant leader. It's not about you. And next thing you know, a lot of these coaches are looking around in their late 20s, early 30s, mid 30s, and they're just in a shit situation. And I don't think that they realize that some coaches give that advice because they don't want to give you the real advice, because to your point, they don't really want competition. There's this scarcity mindset. And, there's definitely this scarcity mindset. And for me, I know, like, I'd always rather go down swinging in a pool of authenticity than to be in the spotlight because I was just full of shit, you know? And I don't think sometimes people really take the time to think, is this quote unquote helpful advice that I'm getting really as helpful as it seems? Because if it seems a little bit too simple, you might need to reconsider that.
Brett, do you find that to be the norm with strength coaches? Because it is a dog eat dog environment. In that.
Yeah, I mean, without a doubt. I made a course that was part love letter, part diss record to the industry in that way, called Valued, that was all about, you know, think about how astonished I was that I said, oh my gosh, you guys don't get training on communication in this. It might astonish you to know that literally prior to us putting out that project, there was nothing by any strength and conditioning governing body to help coaches manage their career, their finances, burnout, information overload. And because I knew that I was going to have to battle some of these larger organizations, because they don't want private entities to get that kind of support, they want the money, right? So, and because I knew that there would be people that would be like, when I left the team setting, there were certain people that, you know, they don't want to listen to you because now you're in the private sector. If you're in the private sector and the team setting, there's always this rift and infighting. So what I did is I got coaches together, male, female, minorities, myself, right? I'm a white male, obviously. I got a whole collective of people together and said, we're cutting the bullshit. We're putting everything strength coaches should really know in this course right now. And by and large, to our surprise, then the governing bodies would not accredit it for Con Ed certification for coaches. So we would have coaches that are like, man, I want to do this. There's nothing like it. And then the governing body wouldn't certify it for continuing education. And Steffi, because this is where it comes from. It always comes from some kind of source in any field, right? Yeah. There's, and they said, well, we're sorry. We don't view this as pertinent to the certification that we offer. And I said, so time out. You support strength and conditioning coaches, and they need to have sustainable careers. Because if the most important trait for an athlete, and you know this, you played at extremely high levels, is availability. That's the most important ability you need, availability. Well, isn't the most important thing that strength coaches have then in their career is sustainability? So you don't want to support that. And then, of course, they didn't, because that would require them to rewrite their certification, and that's not going to make them money. And so without a doubt, it is still the, I think the only thing that started to change it, Steffi, is COVID. When COVID hit, a lot of these strength coaches that were like, it's not about me. No, I feel bad. The course blew up. It was like one of those cult movies that like didn't do well in theaters. And then all of a sudden like, and, but that was sad, right? Like that didn't make me happy that the course started to make money because of that. It was like, why did it take that experience for you to realize that nobody's coming to save you? Why did it take that experience for you to realize that you need to be an advocate for yourself? Why did it take that experience for you to wake the F up and take more control over your own career so you can help other people for a longer period of time? Because an empty sack doesn't really stand up very well on its own.
Yeah. I think COVID highlighted so many things. You know, and you talked about the medical field. And it's like you think about now how they, directly they have to communicate, you know, with through a phone, you know, and I've heard horror stories about that, just like no communication or little communication or just terrible. But yeah, I mean, just talking with coaches after COVID and pre-COVID, it was just like their eyes, just like, it was like a whole new world after COVID and like what it highlighted, what they weren't doing, what they were, you know, like, so I feel like everyone learned a lot through that time.
Without question. All right. Last one. Cause you have been a champion and we have hit you with all, we've hit you with a lot. We like, I'm sorry if you're, you know, this is no walk in the park. And I know sometimes people are like, hey, can you send us stuff in advance? It's like, no, we want that real. And you're doing a good job with it. All right. Let me decide how much do I want to challenge you? You know, we'll go a little abstract here. You can't fail with this one. And also don't feel pressure to go crazy deep, take it wherever you want. But it's been a while since I've asked a truly abstract question to kind of end this show. What's something you believe that most people don't? You can take a minute. It's fine. You can take, I don't have any cool music. We'll see if we have a, oh no, that's the applause one. There's another one here that I think is crickets chirping, but we'll leave it. What do you believe that most people don't? It could be, we had one person say they named a villain in a movie and they said, I actually think that villain's a hero. We've had some people say that, you know, they just think pizza is awful. And then we've had some people that get really deep with some other stuff. So there's no, you can't lose here. Oh yeah. I love it when there's dead air.
We call it letting it breathe.
That's what it's doing. It makes the wine better.
I'll give you an example of something that like I thought about recently that was like unpopular because, there was a rapper, Lil Nas X, and he had a video that came out and it was for that Montero song.
Yeah.
Interesting music video. I think a lot of people didn't like it.
Why don't you describe it? Why don't you describe it for us?
He gave Satan a lap dance.
Yeah.
In the video. And I was watching it and I, you know, if you think about it, you could go, your opinions could be wherever, but
sure.
Most people I think were like, whoa, like way too much.
Oh yeah.
And I felt that way. And then I took a step back and I was like, the creative genius that it took to think about this, visualize it, conceptualize it, and then make it happen. And maybe that's how he felt. And he portrayed it in a way that like he was mocking people. So I think it was like the creativity that some people get knocked for because it might be like, ooh, and ah, and all that. And I think that like sometimes like it's okay to like if that was disturbing to watch. And like, that's okay. Like, it can be disturbing. Like, that's his creative process. And I actually didn't hate it. I appreciated it. And like, I'm religious, but like, when you watch that music video, and your audience is going to watch it and be like, wow, Steffy, really?
That's not the case. Anybody that listens to our stuff knows that we're about, like, part of the reason the world is so polarized is people don't know how to play nice in the gray area, right? Like, not everybody has to agree on everything, and that's okay. It doesn't mean they have to fight about it. You know, I would say, I would say where I'm on a similar track with you is, I think of, what Dave Chappelle just got torn apart, right, for his Netflix comedy special. And I had watched that, and obviously, we have a member of the LGBTQ community as like, she's my business partner and become one of my better friends, right? Like, we love her. Yeah. And her and I haven't had this conversation, but like, you know, Jay-Z weighed in on this, and Jay-Z was said, hey, listen, like, true art has to cause conversation. Like, true art has to cause conversation. I mean, it just does. And that Chappelle documentary caused conversation. And you know, I remember my wife and I watched it, and you know, we were like, it seems like he's making his point pretty clear to me. And the other side just kind of wanted to be like, no, like, this is not okay. And it's like, we have lost the ability to scale back and say, why are we all so uncomfortable getting so uncomfortable? You know, even when it pertains to things like nudity, thousands of years ago, Greek and Roman statues can show the human body and it's all of its beauty. Now you can turn on TVs and people's heads can get blown off, but heaven forbid you see a naked body. Heaven forbid kids get sex education. Heaven forbid we train communication. Heaven forbid we do anything that like could make us open our eyes to an alternative, adjacent, possible future, or just, you know what, just see something and say, that's not for me. You know, you don't have to be like, my God, Steffy, I'm going to cancel you and you're, you know, nah, that's not for me. Or yeah, that's interesting. But now everybody's got to go, it's wild. And I don't know how you manage it. I don't know, because it's got to affect you.
I think like, you're not allowed to openly interpret something without feeling boxed to one side.
Yep.
And that's, I want to interpret something and I don't want to be boxed in at all. And you couldn't box me in. But I love the Chappelle special. I watched it 3 times to see if I missed something that was like totally screwed up, messed up. And you have to like, let the creative process flow, and we don't let other people like interpret for themselves.
And didn't you think he was clear? I mean, I thought he was hyper clear, especially when he told the story of his friend Daphne, you know, and he said, listen, like, this was, he's like, I want to have this conversation. I want to talk about this. But like, I don't know. I felt like, of course, if you watch it just up to 30 minutes or if you don't watch the whole show, you're going to be like, nope, not for me. But like, people don't, to use your language, they don't let it breathe, right? Finish the whole thing, review it again. And of course, Dave knew what he was doing, right? Sharp guy, creating controversy, got views. So nobody's saying Dave's got clean hands. We're just saying that like, look at the magnitude of the reaction, and is it always warranted? Is it always warranted? Or are we maybe not being discerning and open enough? I mean, what did you think about it? Do you think he was clear?
I think he has a very special ability as an orator, as a performer, as a comedian, to have very serious conversations and topics in a comedic way, and to have like almost like an open forum of heavy topics. Yeah. And he brings all these people together and they laugh and they talk about it. And I, you know, the reaction sometimes I'm just like, can you just let him do what he does, because now you're having a conversation. Maybe you weren't going to have that conversation before, but we just are quick to yell before we're quick to listen. Yeah. And that's what really bothers me sometimes with the way that, like, you know, I've eliminated most of my social media, honestly, because it's just like a hellhole. Like, yeah. I don't know, you know, how many different platforms you use, but like, I basically just use Instagram now because, and it's pretty much ads, but like, it's just not good for you. It's not good for us.
No, I mean, it definitely has become a pretty evil place. I've talked about on this show before where, you know, I commented in something in support of something, and because, you know, I'm a white male, I got raked over coals. And then somebody saying, oh, boohoo, you're a white male, we're this and this. And then it's also like, good Lord. Like, now I made one statement that I think this, and then somebody says this, and you don't have it as bad as that person. And it's just, it's so wild. Like, you can't win. And most of these people, that it's become a zero sum game, which is the lack of social intelligence we need to move forward. If I said, oh, my arm hurts, and you're like, yeah, I broke my leg. Like, I'm not going to be the, well, way to one up me, Steffi. And I think it's interesting because why, and to close this out, and then we're going to tell everybody where to get in contact with you, because I could talk to you for like 20 hours and you're coming to one of our workshops. Even if I have to kidnap you, you're coming. Obviously on the house. I was trying after that Chappelle's special to look up the etymology of comedy, right? What was the origin? And as with anything, there's some debates here. There's debates that, but I remember finding something from Oxford Languages that talks about the origin came from like late Middle English, and it was as a subgenre of drama. And I thought, well, that's odd. And we, of course, know that, that symbolism of the arts, right? The laughing, the two masks, one's laughing, one's sad because some are a tragedy or a comedy. But that's kind of what our world's become, right? Because maybe we don't know how to talk to each other. Maybe we don't know how to develop theory of mind, and we're taking people and life a little too literally instead of giving people grace. And I don't know, for me, that's why you've got to focus more on communication. For me, that's why I look up to somebody like you that's out there doing that daily with a wide range of individuals under a wide range of contexts, all while trying to manage your own demons in your life. And it's why I have so much love and respect for you.
Brett, I could probably talk to you for another hour, but I really enjoyed our conversation. I am going to come to one of your courses. I'm going to bring my sister. She's an entrepreneur. She opened up a restaurant with her husband. I invested in it, and I'm actually going to work there later tonight. And so four kids, has her own restaurant, seats about 250 people. And but communicating, especially with a huge staff, you know, like she is life of the party. But I would bring her, and we'll do it. This has been great. And I think that I wish we could have more of these conversations, just like one in person, but like, especially in my industry, like one-on-one with, you know, other people that do the same job. And we just like talked, you know, and, you know, we could all be better. You know, it just doesn't happen, unfortunately, but maybe we can move the needle.
Listen, I feel like all you got to do is pitch during your next contract negotiation an Art of Coaching segment on ESPN, and you and I can have our own show.
Did Golic not pitch that, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I'd have to ask him. Golic promised a lot of things, you know, and Mike's Mike. He's busy. I got to give him a call, but you know what? Now to think of it, I think I'd rather co-host with you anyway. So the Art of Coaching segment, listen, you got to update on injuries. You got to update on all these things. What about this? There's a market for it.
Yeah. Well, what you do is I'm not even kissing ass. I'm really not, because there's just such a market for it right now, because like we don't talk to each other anymore. And like everyone needs to get better at understanding, talking to people and listening. So I'm looking forward to it. I hope you enjoyed me talking. Hopefully I didn't run on too much, but you gained a little bit out of it, so that's always good, right?
Where can we support you? Where can people go to support all things Steffi?
I use Instagram. That's my social media. That's how people can get in touch with me. There's an email link on my Instagram. It's at Steffi_Sorensen. You know, I do some public speaking. I love talking to younger kids, people looking to get into the industry. I really enjoy doing that. I want to help younger kids, because like no one really helped me coming up, yeah. You know, so that's kind of where I try to give back as much as I can. So,
well, perfect. Well, guys, as always, check the show notes. We'll have all those links so you can keep in touch and support Steffi. And as always, if you enjoy this podcast and the conversation, we try to keep it real. We try to keep these topics, things that, like, you know, stir up a little bit of emotions, but also give you real insight. So if it helped you, please send it along to a friend. And Steffi, thank you again for coming on to this episode of the Art of Coaching Podcast.